log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Boris Johnson faced mounting pressure on Monday night, 26th of April, as Conservative insiders added weight to claims that the Prime Minister said he would rather see bodies pile up than order another lockdown. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and senior ministers emphatically denied, he said, no more lockdowns, let the bodies pile high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Jessica Elgott and Robert Booth. The piece is titled Pressure Mounts on Johnson Over Alleged Let the Bodies Pile High Remarks. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced mounting pressure on Monday night, 26th of April, as Conservative insiders added weight to claims that the Prime Minister said he would rather see bodies pile up than order another lockdown. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and senior ministers emphatically denied, he said, no more lockdowns, let the bodies pile high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year. The claim followed a briefing war at the weekend between Johnson and his former chief aide Dominic Cummings, who resigned from Downing Street after what was believed to be a power struggle with the Prime Minister's fiancée, Carrie Symons. The government is also facing growing calls for a public inquiry into a pandemic that left the United Kingdom with one of the worst death tolls among major economies last year. First reported in the Daily Mail on Monday, Boris Johnson's alleged comments were supposedly made after he felt corralled into agreeing to a four-week lockdown last November, months after it was recommended by sage scientists to curb soaring coronavirus cases. He apparently warned he would never again back another national lockdown. Meanwhile, ITV reported source claims that the let the bodies pile high comments were shouted from an office in Downing Street after a crunch meeting with ministers, rather than during the meeting. Speaking to The Guardian, a source corroborated that account and hinted that the comments had been heard by a small number of people outside Boris Johnson's office. A second source who did not hear the comments directly said there had been chatter about them in Downing Street last year, though the phrase the source expressly recalled was no more lockdowns, no matter the consequences. The source said they understood the comments to have been made in frustration and underlined that the Prime Minister went ahead with a third lockdown in January. Despite on-the-record denials from Boris Johnson and his spokesperson, the BBC also said it had confirmed the remarks with its sources and said they were made during a heated discussion in No. 10 Downing Street. Michael Gove, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, defended the Prime Minister in the House of Commons on Monday. Michael Gove said, "I was in the meeting that afternoon with the Prime Minister and other ministers. The Prime Minister made the decision in that meeting to trigger a second lockdown. He made his subsequent decision to trigger a third lockdown. he told the House of Commons. This is a Prime Minister who's been in a hospital himself in intensive care. The idea that he would say any such thing I find incredible. I was in that room, I never heard language of that kind. One source who spoke to The Guardian said Michael Gove did not hear the comments himself and suggested that ministers who did not know if the comments were true or not should not deny them so strongly. Amid growing anger over the alleged comments, Labour's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, said Boris Johnson has degraded the office he holds with rampant and overwhelming sleaze, but making light of more than 127,000 deaths has happened on his watch and then trying to cover it up is a new low. This must now end. The Scottish National Party SNP said the Prime Minister should resign if it was proved that he made the remark. There have been suggestions that Dominic Cummings has taped evidence to back up claims he is poised to make when he gives evidence to MPs next month. For members of the COVID-19 bereaved families for justice group, the alleged comments were a punch in the stomach to all those grieving and compounded their anger at the government's claim it will be too busy for months to launch a public inquiry into the UK's handling of the pandemic. Dozens of grieving families took to social media to post pictures and memories of their loved ones that they had lost. COVID-19 bereaved families for justice said Boris Johnson's callous comments will have caused untold hurt to thousands of us. It said that despite 7 requests, Johnson has declined to meet with the group. These bodies were our loved ones, it said. Mothers and fathers, daughters and sons, brothers and sisters, grandparents, husbands and wives. Those who have lost their loved ones already have to cope with the lack of dignity many of their loved ones faced as they passed. Is it too much to ask that the Prime Minister would be sympathetic and respectful of our loss? This demonstrates exactly why an urgent inquiry is so vital to understand the decisions and considerations in protecting our loved ones that the government chose. Prime Minister Johnson says suggestions he had made the remarks about letting bodies pile up were total rubbish, he said. What I certainly think is that this country has done an amazing job with the lockdowns and they've been very difficult and they've been very tough for people and there is no question about that. Nobody wants to go into a lockdown, but they've helped us. The discipline the public has shown has helped us to get the numbers of cases down very considerably. Boris Johnson's official spokesperson also denied the claims to reporters. This is untrue. And he has denied saying that.
Communique.
Leaked documents expose how major news outlets like the BBC and Reuters were contracted by the British government to push an anti-Russian narrative and further British interests inside Russia and in its neighboring countries. Many of these materials were marked confidential by Her Majesty's government, hoping they'd never see the light of day and that no one would publicly scrutinize them. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. For several years now, we've constantly heard allegations in the media of how Russia has been spreading fake news and disinformation and manipulating social media sites and running troll farms and even journalists. to meddle in the political affairs of the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies. Well, it turns out the United Kingdom has been doing precisely that to Russia. A little hypocritical, don't you think? In a package of leaked documents posted online by the hacker collective Anonymous, we learn how Britain's foreign ministry, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or FCO, sought to spread anti-Russian propaganda and promote narratives that were favorable to Britain and its allies. Under the FCO's Counter-Disinformation and Media Development Program, the British government issued this invitation to tender offering millions of pounds for contractors to allegedly develop a, quote, network of NGOs exposing disinformation, unquote, stated as part of the program's broader goal is to weaken Russian influence in neighboring countries. One of the parties that responded with a bid is the Zinc Network, a collective which includes organizations like Bellingcat and the Institute for Statecraft. Bellingcat has previously denied receiving any funding or information from the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, yet here we see Bellingcat bidding for a contract from none other than the FCO. And in 2018, they pushed this narrative, which the UK, France, and the US used as a pretext, as a justification to go and bomb Syria. How bizarre. These leaked documents also go on to show how BBC Media Action and the Reuters Thomson Foundation, which are supposed to be the non-profit charities of BBC and Reuters respectively, were also awarded contracts by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Despite the original announcement by the FCO stating that the program is supposedly open and no attempt should be made to disguise activity, the contract with Reuters, for example, clearly says otherwise and is marked confidential, as are many other documents, which seems a bit odd if you're allegedly trying to promote journalistic standards and ethics to be participating in a secret program with the British government. These documents show how all these various outlets were telling the FCO about the thousands of journalists and contacts that they possess across the world, as if they're somehow boasting how far they can spread propaganda on behalf of Her Majesty's government. This propaganda is a spiderweb, frankly, of synthetic media groups and fronts for British intelligence. And you may recall some of these names, some of these groups like Albany or perhaps the Integrity Initiative, which were also implicated in the British government's propaganda network against Syria, aiming to promote regime change through all these fronts like ARC and IncoStrat, who are also running the White Helmets. Yes, it's a lot to digest, and it's done that way on purpose so that no one knows what's going on and everything remains obfuscated. These news outlets, like Reuters and the BBC, they claim to have an independent editorial board and to be transparent and objective. Yet when it comes to their supposed non-profits, I mean, there's nothing ethical going on here. Anyone could agree that all of these shady practices have nothing to do with upholding journalistic standards, to say the least. It's interesting to see how the British government is doing exactly what it's been accusing Russia of doing for years. Russophobia has always been an effective political tool, you know, accusing someone of working for the Russians or being a communist in order to smear them. This goes back to the days of the Cold War and the Red Scare and McCarthyism. However, ever since the 2016 US presidential elections, when Donald Trump beat the DC establishment favorite, Hillary Clinton, we've heard nonstop whining from the media and politicians in the United States about this made-up Russian interference, Russiagate. And after Trump won, exorbitant amounts of time and resources were wasted on trying to prove that there was some kind of link between his campaign and Russia with the Mueller report and various other congressional reports that amounted to absolutely nothing. And this is not just in the United States, of course. This is also something that transpired and was carried over into the UK on the other side of the pond. This craze of supposed Russian meddling and disinformation also took root there. And that's no surprise. Wherever the United States goes, the UK follows. We saw former Prime Minister Theresa May decry alleged Russian interference in Britain's elections. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Brexit. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Britain's general elections, in the Scottish referendum even. And just like in the United States, the British government went and started various inquiries, providing an official stamp of approval on its conspiracy theory to blame Russia. Max Blumenthal published an article on the investigative journalism website, The Gray Zone, unpacking the contents of these leaked documents, the stated purposes, goals, and actors involved in these anti-Russian propaganda networks that were cooked up by the British government. And if the contents weren't explosive enough, the article garnered even more attention after Twitter put a warning label underneath anyone who posted it, stating that it may contain hacked materials, as if to say that it were somehow hazardous and to disincentivize people from reading it. Another clear attempt at censorship just because the article, the story, doesn't suit the narratives of Western governments. How surprising. Now, the hypocrisy, frankly, couldn't be clearer. You know, one need only look at other news stories involving leaked documents from other governments, particularly in countries the UK and the US do not like, which received no warning label from Twitter. You can go and post them right now. There will be no warning on them. And just recently, for example, The Intercept published a story which supposedly included leaked documents from the Chinese government. There's no warning label on their tweet when they share the article. We don't even know if these documents are real. It doesn't matter. They can post them without any form of censorship or impediment. The Intercept has also published alleged documents containing hacked cables from Iran. Is there any so-called fact-checking to check if they're real? Or if they are real, was there any warning label on them about hacked materials? Of course not. It's so evident that these big tech and social media giants, who are a main source of news for many Americans and Westerners, they have a double standard. They want to enjoy the privilege of being treated as a platform so that they can't be held accountable for anything people post there, while also performing the activities of a publisher who picks and chooses what to release. And not only that, they also apply another double standard towards news stories that are adversarial to governments that the West is at odds with, while limiting and censoring journalists that question Western narratives and imperialism. Max Blumenthal, journalist and founder of The Gray Zone, who unpacked the contents of these latest FCO leaks showing how the British government contracted media outlets to sow anti-Russian dissent and pro-NATO sentiment, joins me now to talk more. Thanks for coming on the show, Max. Good to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So, Max, I'll start out with the obvious one here. You know, we've been told for years that it's Russia who's meddling in other countries and in Western democracies and their affairs. And you look at these FCO documents, and turns out everything they accused Russia, they're doing. What do these documents tell us exactly?
Yeah, you said it perfectly. The British state, which really is acting as this sort of frontline proxy for Washington here in the new Cold War containment strategy against Russia, is doing everything that it accuses Russia of doing. This is all confirmed. We have the hard details, and this is only a scintilla of what it's probably doing. This is just what we know. And there are hundreds of documents here. I focused on the ones that revealed Reuters through its charitable nonprofit arm, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and the BBC through its nonprofit arm, BBC Media Action, as well as smaller self-styled independent outlets like Bellingcat and Medusa as essentially intelligence contractors for the British Foreign Office. And, you know, if you look at the whole scope of the documents, they're all focused on trying to counter and squelch Russian media that supports the national interests of the Russian government and the Russian state. And they're focused not only internally inside Russia, but also in Russia's near abroad in the Baltics, Ukraine, Central Asia. They're using not only smaller media outlets and these major media organizations like Reuters, which is the largest media organization in the world. They're also creating family-oriented theatrical events in public parks in the Baltics or soap opera TV dramas, all sorts of programming to weaponize their media prowess, funded all by the British Foreign Office, to basically hack the brains of the Russian-speaking population within Russia's sphere of influence and affect attitudinal changes. We constantly saw these phrases in the documents, attitudinal changes to make them more pro-NATO. So what Reuters focused on was Russian journalists and bringing Russian journalists over to the UK, funded by the British Foreign Office through tours, and it was all kind of covert. The contracts that I published at the Gray Zone, they're marked secret, confidential, classified.
Yeah. They're engaging in secrecy. There's a covert element to what they're doing, right? They're trying to hide what's going on. And I mean, isn't that a bit odd considering they're allegedly promoting unbiased journalism and ethics?
Well, in the 60s and 70s, Reuters ran a program for the MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, to produce anti-Soviet media in Latin America and to brand it as kind of independent. It was exposed because the documents were declassified and Reuters came out and said, we don't do this anymore. This was all in the past. It was a Cold War thing. We refer you to our trust principles, which pledge independence and editorial integrity. And what these documents show here is that they are doing the same exact thing, the same program is in play, and that they've lied. So they have worked to keep these programs secret. One document reveals Thomson Reuters in its bid to the British Foreign Office, describing how well it kept secret a delegation of Russian journalists to the UK during the Sergei Skripal poisoning intrigue. And they said, Reuters said, we were coordinating constantly with the British Embassy in Moscow to keep this under wraps. And as I mentioned, the contracts between Reuters and the British Foreign Office are marked private and confidential. So they obviously didn't want the British public to know that they're doing this. They certainly don't want the Russian government or Russian public to know about this. And they boast about creating a network of 400 journalists inside Russia. And I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what these documents reveal.
So, I mean, if you recall in 2020, YouTube said it's going to be banning videos that contain hacked materials. And, you know, Twitter is citing this hacked materials policy when they censored the Hunter Biden story by the New York Post and locked their account. And now this term hacked materials resurfaces as a label under your article. Where do you think they're going with this ultimately?
Well, just straight up censorship. With the Twitter label, what so many young people saw who are ideologically unmoored was that somebody who just simply went out and told the truth got soft censored. And what they see with Julian Assange, if they learn about that, is that someone who simply went out and published true facts was tortured and disappeared. So the idea that we have this liberal society where the truth can prevail and that the society can still be resilient enough and maintain its own national security and advance its national interests while there is a free discourse and citizens are able to criticize their government, that whole veneer has been completely ripped off by these episodes. And it just it's like an onion that just keeps getting peeled away and peeled away until we reach the core, which is just this rotten, festering orb of cynicism and crude, raw power. And I think we're very close to that core right now.
Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for your time. It's great having you on. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
Chris Williamson, former member of parliament and close ally of Jeremy Corbyn, attempted to scrutinize these very same programs, particularly the Institute for Statecraft and its integrity initiative, after it targeted Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party at the time, smearing him as a, quote, useful idiot from Moscow, unquote. As a member of parliament, he submitted a question to Alan Duncan, who at the time was the deputy to Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Williamson was inquiring about the nature of these programs, but was stonewalled repeatedly on grounds of national security. Chris joins me now. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
No, thanks for inviting me back, Richard. Good to be here.
So, Chris, we've been hearing for years now that it's Russia that's, you know, running all these disinformation campaigns and meddling in the US and UK affairs. And it seems now from these FCO leaks that we're doing that in other countries. As a matter of fact, to Russia specifically. I mean, isn't that a bit, you know, hypocritical of us?
Very hypocritical, and I think the political class and the establishment in Britain are guilty of hypocrisy and hyperbole in equal measure. And, you know, Russia may very well be seeking to promote its interests through engaging in an information war. I don't know. There's, as I say, a lot of hyperbole about it. But what is absolutely certain is that we know that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are engaged in a very significant information war effort, aided and abetted by the so-called independent British Broadcasting Corporation and, of course, Reuters, the biggest media organisation anywhere in the world. And, you know, this goes against the kind of whole ethos, allegedly, of Reuters, who, when they were exposed after papers were revealed under the kind of 30-year rule when cabinet papers are put into the public domain, and it came out that they'd been working hand in glove with the British state to, you know, engage in a propaganda offensive against the former Soviet Union. They were, you know, very apologetic about that and regretful, and said, you know, this goes against their ethos, and we certainly don't do anything like that today. And yet we now know from this latest revelations that's precisely what they are doing. And it's pretty shocking, really. And, you know, it just sort of shows the real double standards that are at play here.
So, Chris, there's a video of you in 2019 when you were trying to uncover what's going on. You went and confronted, actually, the Institute for Statecraft at their headquarters in London, and even went to Scotland. Can you tell us what you found out about the Institute for Statecraft, their integrity initiative, and, you know, how the government was essentially trying to stonewall you and block you from finding out what was going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, when the kind of hacktivist group Anonymous put a lot of documents into the public domain, which exposed the activities of the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects called the Integrity Initiative, I started asking questions because, excuse me, within those papers it was revealed that they were engaged in a propaganda offensive against the leader of the Labour Party and some other key figures at a senior level inside the party, which at that time, of course, was promoting a socialist programme at home and an anti-imperialist agenda in terms of its foreign policy. And of course, this was unconscionable to the establishment, to the military industrial complex, to the Zionist lobby. And so there were a lot of powerful forces obviously ranged against it. And so I started to ask some questions because it became apparent from these papers that they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn, smearing him, you know, using social media platforms to do that. And discovered through a series of parliamentary questions that the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the Ministry of Defence had awarded the Institute for Statecraft and its Integrity Initiative in the previous 18 months alone in excess of £2 million. However, when I sought to get further information about their activities, they clammed up and said that this would undermine the effectiveness of the programme, citing national security and a whole manner of other ridiculous excuses. So I then took it upon myself to try and find out a little bit more information directly from the organisation, and went to Scotland to their registered office, only to find that it's a semi-derelict former paper mill at the end of a half-mile dirt track. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really. They do have offices in London, and as you mentioned, I did go and try to seek some information from the people there. And a chap who... one of the founders of the Institute for Statecraft, Dan Lafayette, opened the door to me. And when I introduced myself and said I was Chris Williamson, MP for Derby North, I'd got some questions about their activities, he unceremoniously slammed the door in my face. I did try to shout a few questions through the closed door. And the thing about the Institute for Statecraft is that they have a range of what they refer to as clusters, journalists, tame journalists and academics, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe and around the world. And their alleged aim is to counter, you know, Russian disinformation. But it is interesting that, you know, this outfit is getting that level of support and the involvement of the BBC and, as I've said, Reuters. It is very, very troubling. And it's just the double standards which gets me. They you know, Russia is held up as this bogeyman, and yet the UK is engaged in far more intense sort of information war activities than anything that Russia's ever done. And I just think that's really worrying.
So these government programs, I mean, they're not just for foreign affairs in Russia, its neighboring countries, in Syria, but also at home in the UK, right? Because if they were smearing Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader and leader of the opposition, you know, that means they're going after dissidents or opponents or people they don't like, or people who are considered perhaps anti-establishment inside the UK, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, certainly that was one of the main reasons why, of course, I started to ask questions about what their activities, because they were using public money to attack the leader of the official opposition in the UK. And, you know, that is an attack on our democracy, it seems to me. And that's why I was calling for a public inquiry. But of course, you see, the agenda that Jeremy Corbyn was spearheading was one which threatened the status quo. It threatened the huge profits that were being made from the military industry, the defence industry in this country. And of course, it threatened the sort of foreign policy of Britain, the kind of consensus that there's been amongst parties, both parties, really ever since the war in terms of its attitude towards Israel. But we had in Jeremy Corbyn somebody who was a very strong anti-imperialist, somebody who was a big supporter of the Palestinian cause, somebody who had, criticised the Israeli state, the Israeli regime, demanded that they comply with their international law obligations. And therefore, he was, it seems to me, seen as a legitimate target, because that would have indeed called into question the UK's role in supporting Israel and supporting the hugely profitable arms industry in this regime. That obviously was something that they weren't prepared to countenance. And of course, it went further than that, because Jeremy was somebody, and the agenda that he was putting forward, of course, gave us hope that we could turn the page on the neoliberal consensus that has caused so much despair and created so much poverty in Britain, the fifth biggest economy in the world, where we have 14 million people living in poverty. And had that opportunity, I think, over time, the Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn would have indeed done that. And that's why I think they targeted him. They targeted him because of his domestic policy and obviously his foreign policy. These were things which were very powerful vested interests that couldn't be allowed to stand. And they did everything they could, therefore, to stop them, including using public money to go after, as I say, the leader of the official opposition in the country. As I say, this goes to the root, it goes to the core of what our democracy is supposed to be about. I mean, it's almost incredible. If you read it in a screenplay before these documents came into the public domain, you'd say, well, that's all very interesting, but it would never happen in real life. But of course, often truth is stranger than fiction, and here's a case in point.
The hypocrisy of the British government and these supposed NGOs and news outlets that they've cooperated with is frankly stunning. They claim to be fighting disinformation while spreading disinformation themselves. It's just plain old propaganda. And no less from establishments like the BBC and Reuters and others who claim to be superior and claim to uphold journalistic standards. For years, we've heard nothing but anti-Russian propaganda from these very same outlets, and fear-mongering about Russian interference from lawmakers on both sides of the pond, and virtually every mainstream media outlet reporting that as fact. Now, when we have a story of the exact same caliber with official government documents proving that the United Kingdom has been doing the exact same thing, complete silence. The media can't even be bothered to report on these explosive revelations of the United Kingdom meddling in the affairs of foreign countries and major news outlets cooperating with them, abdicating their journalistic ethics and standards, as if they ever had any to begin with. Moreover, we see clearly once again how Silicon Valley, how all these tech giants and social media companies are just an extension of the government and a tool used to manipulate public opinion and control reporting that is adversarial to interests of the West. It's an extension of the national security state. Again, is it deplorable? Absolutely. Are we surprised? Not really. We know that these practices have been going on for decades, since the Cold War. Regime change and propaganda, these are Britain and America's strong suits and a habit that they can't seem to kick. They continue these Cold War practices while pointing the finger at Russia and accusing Russia of the very same things that they decry. You couldn't find a stronger case of the pot calling the kettle black. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. One of the main factors which make one distant from the divine mercy is following carnal desires. There are many ethical ways for controlling carnal desires. Fasting is one of the best ways. Fasting strengthens self-restraint and helps the individual avoid committing sin. Indeed, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in the sermon on the occasion of the arrival of Ramadan, "As the crescent of the month of Ramadan rises, devils are chained. So, plead to God not to dominate them over you." Man's desires are good if they are applied properly. For instance, the desire for eating is good for keeping our health, but if we exceed in eating, our health will be harmed. Sexual desire has been created for continuation of generations, but if it is used out of the wedlock, it will destroy family and society. Unfortunately, some people go to the extremes and cause problems for the individual and the society. If a person breaks his fast intentionally without any reason, he should both fast later on and atone for it. But if one breaks his fast out of fear or danger to his life, he has to only fast later on as compensation and won't pay any other atonement. The point to note here is that if a person thinks that fasting of Ramadan is not obligatory for him, but later on he understands that it was obligatory, he should both fast as compensation and pay atonement. Now, if a person puts his head completely in water while he doesn't know that it nullifies fast, his fast is nullified and he should only fast later on, but he shouldn't pay atonement. If, for example, a person jumps into the water to save a drowning one, his fast is nullified, but he shouldn't pay atonement. He should just fast later on as compensation. When some food comes up to the mouth from stomach, a fasting person should not swallow it. If he does, his fast will be nullified, and he has to both fast later on and pay atonement. Dear listeners, God says in Surah Qadr that the night of Qadr is better than 1,000 months. This surah reads, "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Indeed, we sent it down on the night of ordainment. And what will show what the night of ordainment is? The night of ordainment is better than 1,000 months. In it, the angels and the spirit descend by the leave of their Lord with every command. It is peaceful until the rising of the dawn." Imam Reza, peace upon him, says, God ordains in the night of Qadr whatever will take place in 1 year, the good, the evil, life and death. So, whatever God ordains in this night will definitely happen. That the night of Qadr is in the month of Ramadan is accepted by all Muslims from all denominations. God says in Ayah 185 of Surah Baqarah that Ramadan is the month in which the Noble Quran has been sent down. And in Surah Qadr, he says that the Noble Quran was sent down on the night of Qadr or ordainment. Thus, the night of Qadr is surely in the month of Ramadan. But it is not exactly known if it is on the 19th, 21st, or 23rd of the night of this month. There is a mystery behind this lack of clarity. According to the religious teachings, it has been hidden like many things that are not known. Imam Ali, peace upon him, said that the night of Qadr is hidden so that the faithful spend more nights in prayer and supplication and seek God's forgiveness for their sins in more nights. In other words, this gives them more time to seek God's proximity through purifying their soul and heart. May God help us benefit from these 3 nights. Amen. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000, 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
Well, last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and, I think, 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So, I'm a big fan of this film.
So, as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of those situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere. But we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness, right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant, and what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film's portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit. Council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold in off for profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods? It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
if you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense, what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
was the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point in shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? So what are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know, someone who's
scrounging.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engaging in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the new Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on Haygett, but my understanding is that some of the social rented properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes, and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 to £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears,